be in the car anymore. I want to go home. I don't want to go to Wally World.
Clark, under the circumstances, I wouldn't mind if we just went home. In retrospect, it seems like a pretty bad idea driving out. It's been one disaster after another.
Yeah, it's been a real drag, Dad. Maybe we can try it some other time. Wally World's overrated anyway.
Maybe we'll never get to Wally World, but school's out, the solstice is right around the corner, and that means it's time for a road trip. But this time, between travel bingo and the license plate game, pull out the smartphone and load up some special apps designed with the road traveler in mind. Joining us now on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher to talk about that and tell us whether there's an app to answer the eternal question, are we there yet? Christina Bonnington, she's a staff writer at Wired, where she covers Apple, Google, and mobile technology. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Hi, Anne. Thanks so much for having me.
Also, listeners, if you have a favorite road travel game, give us a call and share it. It doesn't have to be high tech, but what the heck, because we're talking about road trips. If you have a fun game, give us a call. I've already named, of course, Travel Bingo and the license plate game. All right, Christina, here's an app that I guess is going to be helpful, although I don't know if I want to look at it. It's Gas Buddy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gas Buddy comes in so much handy. I actually went on a road trip about a month ago and down California, and we used Gas Buddy every time we made a stop. Because if you're driving an SUV or a van, you know, saving a couple cents really makes a difference on each gallon of gas.
So what does it do?
So what it does is it plots out gas stations near your location, and then you can pick which one you want to go to. The data is crowdsourced, and users of the app are enticed to contribute and update the prices on gas stations by being entered into a drawing to win a $250 gas card each week, I believe.
So even if you're not looking for gas at that moment, if you're driving by a station and you see the price, you just pop it in there?
Right.
How long's that been around? How is it working?
That app has been around for a while. I've been using it for a year or two now, and it works great. It's super simple. You just pull it up, and then, you know, as you're deciding that you're going to stop soon, and you can see what's up ahead and how far away those gas stations are. And so you can decide, oh, do you want to pay a little bit more for a gas station that's right next to the freeway, or do you want to go maybe a half mile further off the freeway and, you know, save 5 or 10 more cents per gallon.
Does it include other information, like if there's any food or what the bathrooms are like, that kind of thing?
Gas Buddy doesn't have that much information, but there's another app for that called iExit. That app has a lot more information, like things, say you're traveling late at night, you can search specifically for places that are open 24 hours. Mm-hmm. If you've got a dog with you, you can search for restaurants or places to stay that are pet friendly. So if you're looking for more than just gas stations, I'd recommend that app.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and my guest this segment, Christina Bonnington. She's a writer for Wired. We're talking about apps that'll make your road travel a little bit easier this summer, even if the cost of gas won't. Another one, and if you have a question or comment for Christina, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Another one is called Waze, and it's a mapping app.
Yes, so Waze is really interesting. It's another crowdsourced app, and it has a really robust and involved community of users. And what you do when you have the app, you can report if there's an accident, if there's a road blockage, if there's just general traffic. And the app has complex algorithms that determine, you know, are you a trusted user or are you just, you know, some random person submitting something for the first time? And so it kind of weighs your information to then help direct other users of the app around those obstacles. So say it gives you turn-by-turn navigation, and then say a whole bunch of people start reporting there's an accident up ahead. The app will, in real time, reroute you around that accident.
Okay, so if you're just one person saying there's a 10-car pileup on I-75, if you're the only one doing it, they're going to note that.
Right. So they'll note it, but it won't start rerouting users or anything.
Uh-huh.
If, say, 20 or 30 people start saying there's an accident, then they're going to start rerouting other users, you know, for example.
You said, you wrote that it has to remain running in the foreground of your phone to work. What does that mean? Is it a battery hog then?
It can be a bit of a battery hog. It's always pulling your GPS location. You know, it needs to be on the screen. So, you know, screen brightness is one of the biggest battery drains on your mobile device.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if that's not a huge deal, you know, it's something you want to use more in the city than mm-hmm. when on long highway trips. So hopefully if it's just a shorter trip, then the battery life issue isn't such a big deal.
Okay. And another one is Twist, and Twist seems like it does a lot of things. Talk about its main feature.
Yeah, so the main point of Twist is that you can let people know where you are on your trip. So the biggest thing of that is if you're running late, you know, you can let people know very easily that, you know, you're running 15 minutes behind for a meeting, or for me, if I'm doing a long trip, you know, my mom may worry about me, so you know, I can let mom know, like, hey, I'm still on the road, you know, I may be running behind schedule, but, you know, here I am. You can watch my little dot on the map moving. So it's just, you know, giving peace of mind and you know, notifying friends and family where you are without you having to send a text message or make a call.
And I love it that it works. You can coordinate multiple cars. Like if there's a, you know, like my kid's going out to a camp out west, they're taking three buses, you know, they probably try to stay together, but this would be just another insurance.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's a good use of the app as well.
What about privacy?
So that app, it keeps everything, all of it calls, when you're sharing this information, it's called a Twist, and it keeps that information private unless it's private with who you decide to share it with, unless you just, you know, want to share your location. So if you want, you can share your Twist to Facebook or Twitter.
They always ask you.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And this isn't just for driving. You can do this if you're taking a walk in a park, just for someone to make sure that you're, if it's, I actually think it'd be kind of great for older people who sometimes you worry about where they're at, and it could be sort of a little bit of a tracking device.
Absolutely, yeah. And so you can use it whether you're walking, you're riding your bike, or taking public transit, or in the car.
Okay. Then there's iExit, which you already mentioned.
Yes. Yeah, so that one makes it, that one looks up ahead at exits that are coming up, and so you can decide, you know, for me on a road trip, one of the worst things is, you know, you're hungry and tired and you're looking for something to eat and you don't know what's at the next exit and you pull off and it's just a barren wasteland. There's
right.
nothing there. There's like a gas station that's been abandoned for 10 years. So this app prevents that problem. So you can see what's ahead at the next exits, and again, you can search for specific things, like if you have a pet with you or something.
And then, you know, you mentioned it with, I think it was Gas Buddy, but sometimes you do want some decent food. You're sick of fast food, and you're willing to drive that half mile down the road if you knew it was there.
Right. Yeah, so this app will help with that. And then, you know, of course, you can also use Yelp also if you're looking. So say maybe you've already pulled off the exit, you can also use Yelp to figure out what some good general restaurants are in the area.
Okay. Stitcher. Okay. Podcasts. Not turn off the radio.
Indeed, yeah. Right. So, you know, so things like Stitcher are great during those long stretches when, you know, you don't have a good radio connection.
Right.
And so, again, this one is, you know, if it's streaming, it's using a lot of data, so you've got to watch your data usage if you have a limited data a cap on your account.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really great because you can just you can set all your favorite podcasts, and you can search for new ones, and you can just string them all together, and it just plays them one after the other, so you've got a constant stream of entertainment information.
And, of course, it offers recommendations.
Yes, yeah. And it has over 15,000 shows you can choose from. So there's something for everyone.
And it works with the Bluetooth and everything?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, same as your, if your mobile device
right.
is Bluetooth, then you could stream it over Bluetooth.
Okay, so family car games. Apparently nobody wants to participate in that game. But the family car games, you know, we all did them when we were kids. We all did them with our kids. Let's talk about those. Road trip scavenger hunt?
Mm-hmm. So the first app, Family Car Games, that one is actually, it's kind of an interesting app. It's really just a reference tool. It has... It just has instructions for over 100 in-car games that don't require any extra equipment. So it's great for, you know, you're tired of the license plate game. Mm-hmm. And it lets you, you can search for some other type of game. And so, you know, keep the kids entertained and, you know, hunting for different things out on the road. And then Road Trip Scavenger Hunt is another app. And that one. It does use your mobile device, and it gives each person in the car a task, something to look for, you know, maybe something that's striped or someone is looking for a horse. And once that person finds that item, then you can tap their name on the mobile device and they get a point.
Okay, so the family car games, you can sort games by age, friendliness, difficulty, or type of game, or you can shake your iDevice to have the app randomly select a game for you. That's pretty funny. Titles include everything from rock, paper, scissors to ones we've never heard before. And I definitely have not heard the one about Grandma is So Weird. Did you figure out what that is?
I didn't. So I saw the title for that one, but I haven't played that one yet. There's 100 in car games. I think like off the top of my head, I remember playing like maybe like 5, maybe 10. So, I mean, there's a ton of random ones to choose from.
And what about Inky Pinky?
That's another funny one. I can't remember exactly what that one was about.
I mean, we did Grandma is So Weird, but it was just a casual conversation we would have about Grandma is So Weird. She did this or that. But maybe that's what they're talking about. Christina Boddington, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right. We've been talking about apps to guarantee an awesome summer road trip with Christina Boddington, writer for Wired. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org.
Production and consumption and profit, it's capitalism, baby. Except for this.
Even today, you cannot say that the system properly works if there are over a billion people going to bed hungry.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Paul Pullman, the CEO of Unilever, on the goods and the bads of this thing called capitalism. It's next time on Marketplace from APM.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. Learn how your genetic makeup could change the future of medicine. Watch Genomics and the Potential for Personal Treatment, Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday. Last week, documents were leaked that revealed that the National Security Agency is collecting phone data from Verizon. This was not necessarily shocking news for those familiar with the Patriot Act, but in this case, instead of targeting, they were amassing huge amounts of data from all Verizon accounts. And that has privacy advocates and others concerned about the government's power of surveillance. Joining us now to discuss NSA surveillance is Mashable.com political reporter Alex Fitzpatrick. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Hey, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, is the government doing anything illegal?
Well, that's the thing. The government, under its own interpretation, is not doing anything illegal. However, we aren't really clear on what the government's interpretation of Patriot Act and FISA really are anymore. A few senators have been warning us for a while that the government has a secret interpretation of those two acts. That they, as Senator Wyden and Senator Mark Udall, they've been warning for years that if we knew what this interpretation was, we'd be furious, but it's a secret interpretation.
So is it an interpretation that is a carryover from the Bush administration?
It seems to be. I think the biggest news in these recent leaks is that the Obama administration continued and even perhaps expanded upon surveillance programs that we've known for years the Bush administration had enacted. So that's really Obama campaigned on these ideas of more transparency and perhaps lessening surveillance, but in fact he did seem to have done the opposite.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Once again, my guest is Alex Fitzpatrick with Mashable.com. He's a political reporter. We're talking about the NSA surveillance. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what exactly, I know they're collecting data from Verizon, so where, what are they collecting exactly and where are they collecting? Is it just phone numbers? Is it interactions? What?
So the term that's being applied to what's collected from Verizon, and most likely, though we don't have evidence, other providers, is called metadata. And that is essentially defined as data about data. So nobody's listening to anybody's phone calls as far as these leaks go. Or inform us, but instead they can surveil and determine what phone numbers are being dialed. They can tell how long the calls are, the types of devices being called. So if you're calling from an iPhone 5, they can tell that. And privacy advocates have been telling me and posting publicly that they don't have to listen to the actual phone calls to get a whole bunch of information about you from that metadata.
It's like knowing what book you checked out but not knowing whether you read it or not.
Exactly. I think a good relevant example is, say, the government is trying to determine the source of a national security leak that a reporter wrote a story about. They can get that reporter's records and say, okay, you've called these people, you spoke for this long, and this confirms what we've got through other surveillance methods, and it adds evidence that, okay, this is your source for this story that perhaps broke the Espionage Act or something like that.
How much data do they have? How much metadata do they have now? They've been collecting it for years.
They've been collecting it for years. It's difficult to determine exactly how much data that is. But to give you an idea, we've known for a few years that the NSA is building this data center out in the Midwest that is just a gigantic center, solely seemingly for storing data. So it's just this massive data collection place. And to have that much physical room for data storage suggests that they've got quite a lot of data to store. The numbers are just incomprehensible.
Do we know how much they're investing financially in this?
We don't at the time. It's the Internet surveillance program that's been revealed, which is a little bit separate from the phone surveillance. We know cost about $20 million a year. Although that figure is in dispute because that's a very low number for a surveillance program.
It sounds low for anything in the government.
It really does, and that's a little suspicious. That led some people to doubt the quality and the authenticity of that leak, or to at least doubt that we know, or at least suggest that we don't know everything about this program. Perhaps this one program is part of a much bigger web of surveillance programs.
Robin in Dublin, you are on the air with Alex Fitzpatrick of Mashable.com. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. It's an interesting topic, this. I just wanted to recommend a book that I picked up a number of years back called Body of Secrets, A Secret History of the NSA by Daniel Ellsberg.
Uh-huh.
It's about a 700-page tome, and it's rather eye-opening. I mean, think about it. They can read the date off a dime and tell you where it's minted from orbit.
Right.
That's just some of the technology that they have.
I have read that book, and it's a good one. What's interesting is that Ellsberg, who's famous for his involvement in the Pentagon Papers, recently on Twitter called the recent NSA leak the most important in American history, suggesting that it's more important than the Pentagon Papers. And if you're looking for a good book to read, I also recommend Deep State by a friend of mine named E.B. Grady. Very good book to read on the subject.
Thank you, Robin, for that suggestion. Do we know, I mean, if the NSA has ever successfully used information like this metadata in an investigation?
Now, right after the Verizon story came out, House Intel Chairman Mike Rogers said that at least one domestic terrorism attack had been thwarted by data collected by the Verizon program. However, he did not give on-the-record specifics. Later, Reuters reported a top U.S. intelligence official claiming that an attack on the subway in New York City in 2010 had been foiled, but reporting after that suggested that the data used in the court case against the person who was planning that attack was actually obtained under a different program. So that's in dispute right now.
So what all is Verizon, and for all we know, other phone companies, giving the government?
So they're giving the government records, millions of records, apparently, of people's, as I said earlier, people's phone numbers, the call duration, the identifiers on their devices, and so on. And what's interesting is that, obviously, Verizon's denying all this, or at least they're not denying it. They're offering no comment because these letters come with a gag order preventing a company from saying anything about it publicly. So it's tough to really get a firm grip on how extensive this program is.
So the point, yeah, how extensive, how many people, how many, we just don't know.
We also don't know if Verizon has given any effort to fight in court these orders, because those court battles would be secret and out of the public eye.
I wondered if they would have been, that was one of my questions, is that they go to a secret court to get to get permission to actually then use the metadata. And I was wondering if they could be a party to that.
Well, the problem with the secret court from a civil liberties perspective is that in 2012, that secret court rejected zero of the government's 1,700-plus requests for data, and in its entire existence has only denied 0.03% of government requests. So when the president says this program has oversight from all three branches of government, the judicial oversight just isn't there.
I heard that the secret court, it comes across that way, but that what's actually happening is the secret court sending them back to revise their requests until it satisfies the court.
That's certainly possible, and we've seen evidence of that in other types of secret requests to technology companies and telecom providers, where the government will issue a broad request, and the company will fight back and say, you need to narrow this down, and then it comes back and with a more narrow request, which is a good thing for telecommunications and technology companies to be doing.
But ultimately, we're not sure because it's all secret.
Exactly. Sort of an analogous example is Google is secretly fighting what's called a national security letter, 19 of them to be exact, in a California court, but that's all a very secret process. We only know it's Google from leaks, and they're fighting to prevent the government from getting their hands on user data.
Is this the PRISM one?
No, this is separate from PRISM. This has been known for a few weeks, possibly a few months. It's a different process, but it's sort of analogous when you're talking about secret courts and gag orders and whatnot.
Tell us about PRISM. It's internet data, right? And what is it?
It is. PRISM is authorized under the Foreign Services Intelligence Act. Basically, it's what we know now is that it's essentially a way for government agents to get data from technology companies that's already been approved. These requests have already been approved by a secret court, and it's a way for these agents to get data easily from these technology companies, but it's specifically targeted at non-citizens and ideally citizens living abroad. Although if you're collecting email information, Facebook messages, and so on from non-citizens, you might also incidentally collect data from citizens. The NSA says they minimize that data that's collected from American citizens, but those minimization processes are not transparent, and we can't really say, yes, they're doing a good job, no, they're doing a bad job.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Alex Fitzpatrick. He's a politics reporter for Mashable.com. If you have a question or comment for him about this NSA surveillance story, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The president said that no one is listening to our phone calls, but are they reading our email? And is it not so much that they're listening to the phone calls as they're tracking who we're talking to?
Yes, that's the problem. And like I said, as far as email, it's important to keep the PRISM Internet Surveillance Program and the Verizon story a little bit separate because they are a little bit separate in the way that they work. But as far as phone calls go, I believe him, and I think it's accurate that nobody's listening to phone calls. But as I alluded to earlier, you don't need to be listening to a phone call to understand a lot about a person from the data they are collecting, the call durations, the call numbers, et cetera.
This is really confusing a lot of Americans right now. They don't know how to feel about it. The president has said he's willing to open up a debate and discuss, you know, about this program, but so much of it is top secret. I just wonder how we can have a healthy, open discussion about it.
I wonder that as well. When he said that last week, it really aggravated me a little bit, to be honest, because he said he welcomes this debate, but he also said he doesn't encourage leaks, and he doesn't want, they're not really, when I say they, I mean the government, is not really being transparent about how any of these processes work. So I don't understand how we're expected to have an educated, informed debate about these programs without more knowledge about how they work, who's overseeing them, et cetera.
And the leaks, one of the people who has, issued the leak is coming forward. He wants people to know who he is. Some people are calling him a traitor. Others are calling him a whistleblower, at the very least, a hero in the other direction. Is it illegal if we already know the government's doing this because, or that has the authority to do all of this? Are they really leaking anything?
Well, I think Edward Snowden is his name. I think Snowden's leaks certainly reveal new information that the NSA and others in the government certainly would prefer to have been kept private. I do think that they'll try to prosecute him and go after him. For me as a journalist, I tend to err to the side of freedom of speech, free information, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to trust somebody, call him a whistleblower more than a traitor, significantly so.
And does he actually work for the government, or does he work for an agency or a contractor for the government?
He was a contractor for under 3 months, most recently working for a military contractor called Booz Allen Hamilton. They're one of the biggest private contractors that work for the U.S. government. And he was working before that for the CIA as an information analyst. The other story in this is really sort of an indictment of the private contractor industry. So many private non-government employees have top secret clearance, and does this mean that there's more of a threat of intelligence leaks, as we've seen here?
Does the government do this to save money? Why do they contract out these kinds of top secret operations?
Well, that's an open question. I think saving money is certainly part of it. I also think there's an element of just the military-industrial complex at play. There are powers that be that get money from these government contractors into the private sector, and that's a very entrenched interest in Congress and in the country at large.
So, yeah, of course, Booz Allen Hamilton, this isn't the only thing they do for the government.
Right, exactly. They do a lot of different things. I've reported on their involvement in cybersecurity, which is essentially keeping U.S. government and business interests safe from hackers and people who want to steal corporate secrets and government secrets from computer systems.
The authority to do a lot of this existed beforehand, but the Patriot Act solidified it. A lot of this authority, it goes way back.
It does. It goes all the way back to the Foreign Services Intelligence Act of 1978, which was a Cold War device that essentially set up the secret FISA court, which the responsibility of which was to approve government requests to do surveillance on suspected foreign agents inside the country and outside the country. And right after 9/11, the Patriot Act was signed the next month, and that expanded FISA into and modified it for the what I would call the post 9/11 world, for lack of a better term, and expanded it to be, instead of just surveillance of agents of foreign governments, it then applied to surveillance of terrorist groups, non-state actors, et cetera. And then for the next years afterwards, it was expanded more. It was expanded more, and its timeline was expanded for better or for worse.
And you made the point that there were senators, there were lawmakers, federal lawmakers, who were saying from the beginning, you don't know what we're doing. You don't know how big of an expansion this is. The Patriot Act, you just don't understand it, American public. You should be taking a closer look at it. And now we are several years later. I wonder, is the magic of 9/11 wearing off? I know that's more of a sociological question than a political one, but it makes me wonder, are people saying, you know what, we're willing to take our risks?
What's interesting is that Pew Research just did a study along those lines. 56% of Americans think that it's okay to serve phone companies with a secret order. They think that's an acceptable way to fight terrorism. So I don't think that post 9/11 fervor over terrorism has decreased all that much.
Okay. Just a new generation of people growing up, perhaps.
Certainly. And when you break down that data for younger people, it's the group I would include myself in, there is more of an interest in privacy. Which perhaps, even if I'm 24, when you get younger than myself, you start to get to an age bracket that grew up and might not remember 9/11 happening, or was very young when it happened. So they grew up during the war on terrorism, and perhaps it's not as a big of an event in their consciousness, and so they have more of an inclination towards privacy rather than security.
All right. Well, Alex Fitzpatrick, thanks for joining us again to talk about this.
Certainly. Glad to be here.
Alex Fitzpatrick, he's a politics reporter for Mashable. Coming up, Russell Holley from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888.
We got 12 bottles of water, 56 beers, 2 vodkas, 4 whiskey, 6 bottles of wine, tequila, Nutella, cheese, steaks, a Milky Way.
That's Seth Rogen in This Is the End, a parody of end of the world movies. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who co-wrote and co-directed the film and co-wrote Superbad. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
You're mobile, and we are too. Now you can get 89.7 NPR News anytime, anywhere with the free WOSU Public Media mobile app. It features live audio streaming, news stories on demand, and podcasts of your favorite shows. Just go to wosu.org/mobile app and download the app today.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is Tech Tuesday. Apple held its Worldwide Developers Conference yesterday and revealed what we can expect from its new mobile operating system. Joining us now to discuss what changes will be coming to the iPhone is tech blogger for Geek.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
So, what do they have up their sleeve?
Tons of stuff. We have a new operating system for the iPhone, the iPad, and all of the mobile devices from Apple, but we also have a new OS X headed to desktops and laptops. Both of those things were announced yesterday.
So what's different about it?
So we're going to start with iOS 7 for iPhone, iPad, and all that stuff, and it's a complete user interface overhaul. A lot of the stuff that you may look at your iPhone and see as just kind of staples in the iPhone design have been replaced. A lot of the things that look like the game center, for example, where it's got the green felt in the background, mm-hmm. or the calendar that has, you know, stitching, or the fake wood in iBooks. All of those weird kind of like pseudo real, you know, designs. Uh-huh. Have all been just kind of gutted and replaced with very clean lines, very bright colors. Almost everything is on a kind of a frosted white background with very thin, single color lines. The keyboard is, completely redone. It's very flat, but at the same time, it's got this kind of frosted glass feel, so you can still see what's going on behind it a little bit. And everything is done in this kind of weird, flat, layered experience. It's visually very pretty, and it doesn't seem like it takes a whole lot to figure out, you know, what's new and you know where to go and do things. A lot of the buttons are all still in the same place, so it all looks very different, but it all works pretty much exactly the same.
Okay, so is this for the phone and the tablet and on the computer?
This new design is specifically for the phone and the tablet. If you have an iPhone or an iPod mm-hmm. Touch or an iPad, then these are the design changes that are coming. The new OS X doesn't have so much in the way of design changes, but they implemented things like tabbed usage in folders. So if you have multiple folders open, you can actually pull them all together into a single folder, and you'll have them, you know, one folder that has many tabs that you can click across, which actually works really well. There was some new updates to how notifications are received on OS X, so that you can have messages that'll pop up in the corner that you can reply to in line. And if you have news messages and stuff that you normally get through push notifications on your phone, you can now also have those received on your computer. It's really just a ton of little changes that make both of these operating systems feel a lot more polished. It was a lot of really good things.
Okay, so the little television set that's YouTube, that's going to go away? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, so the television design.
Yeah, I'm trying to visualize what you're talking about.
So that was something that was designed by Apple, and that was actually removed in the previous version. Google now makes the design stuff for YouTube. But yes, that is a perfect example of the kind of pseudo-realism stuff that's going away in iOS. You know, the felt and the fake wood and the stitching in calendar and all of those kind of things are all going away.
My guest is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. We are talking about the changes coming to the, he was at the Apple. He wasn't at it, right? You were.
I was watching.
You were watching.
Very focused.
You're they had their Worldwide Developers Conference yesterday, and Russell was paying attention. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. Coming up later, Russell is going to give us some suggestions for high-tech, low-tech, and mid-range tech Father's Day gifts. If you have a question about something you want to give your father, maybe Russell can help you out. Once again, 614-292-8513. So something with iTunes Radio?
iTunes Radio is another thing that was announced. And really, it's just kind of an update to how iTunes in the cloud has been working. The last time that iTunes got revamped, one of the big things that they pushed was that, you know, you could take your entire song library and instead of uploading it to a storage locker, you just allow Apple to scan all of it and then they'll have their own copies of the songs in the cloud that it'll play. And very much in the same way that Google implemented their new radio service, you can now use that same information to create kind of personalized radio services for yourself and that can be shared via iTunes.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like an internet radio service, but it's customized to your experience and the kind of music that you listen to.
What about this multitasking? Isn't that what we're all doing anyways all the time? What are they doing to enhance that fabulous part of our lives?
Multitasking in iOS has always been kind of funny. You know, the big thing about how multitasking works on the iPhone is that apps take up the entire screen. So it's really hard to say, well, we can do two things at the same time. unless you're talking about something like playing music in the background or something like that. So what Apple's doing here with you know, new kind of enhanced multitasking is the operating system itself will pay attention to what apps you use most frequently. And when you have turned on the phone to do anything, really, anytime you've woken up the screen to do something, those apps that you use most will be given the ability to grab updates at that point in the background. So if you have a news feed or, you know, an instant messaging client or something like that you are constantly going to, Apple will give those things priority in the background and let them work a little more seamlessly.
Were they going to do something like have it open up with your camera if that's what you use all the time?
You know, just like before with the lock screen, there's the ability to open to the camera.
Oh, okay.
With the camera icon on the lock screen. It looks a little different now. The lock screen is a little different looking, but it all runs in very much the same way.
Okay. Battery life, is that more to do with the computer or the iPhone and tablet too?
So they haven't said a whole lot about how this new update is going to improve battery life on any of the existing hardware. And I'm sure that, you know, the next version, they'll talk a lot about battery life. But for OS X, one of the big things that they worked on, especially with the laptop line, is having the operating system be more aware of what battery life is using and what tasks are consuming the most battery life, and focusing on muting those applications when they're not necessary. So if you have something that's using a lot of CPU cycles or is requesting a lot of power, and you take, you know, your browser, for example, and put it over top of that window, you're obviously not using that thing that's consuming so many resources. So the background operating system will tune down how much power that is using until you grant focus back to it.
Okay, and is that a big significant change, or is it just an incremental?
It sounds like a really big deal, but I'm really interested to see how useful that comes for people who use multiple windows on a single laptop. A lot of people who use laptops, especially, you know, you typically don't use more than, you know, one or two windows at a time, mm-hmm. you know, either a folder or a browser or something like that. So for someone who uses a lot of windows, this can be either really useful or really detrimental depending on how they multitask it. So I'm very interested to get some hands-on time with it, because I think that, you know, depending on exactly how Apple implemented it, it could either be really, really good, or it could really mess up how some people use their computers.
And as far as the savings on the energy, you know, the battery life, how would you measure that anyways? You just don't have to charge it up as often, or?
Yeah, essentially it would be you don't have to charge it up as often, or you can observe, you know, if you're really technical, you can observe, you know, how much power each individual task is using, you know, over the others, and how many times the CPU has to wake up to complete a task. You know, if it batches it all together, then all of that stuff. I'm glad that I started this by saying, you know, if you're really technical, and then into a technical answer.
And that made me laugh. Yeah, because I'll see how often I have to.
In theory,
plug it in.
You'll get better battery life with OS X.
All right. Let's see. What about Apple's web browser? Safari is getting some improvements.
They said that Safari is getting some pretty significant user improvements, and you know, the whole focus for all web browsers right now is how fast it can handle, you know, multiple applications, how much memory it uses when it's active, and you know, Safari seems to think that Apple seems to think that Safari is going to use significantly fewer resources to accomplish the same tasks as Chrome or Firefox. And in, you know, typical Apple style, they didn't even bother comparing it to Internet Explorer. They just assumed that it's better.
So, and then one other feature is going to be Finder tags. I use an iPhone. I'm not sure what a Finder tag is. What is it? And how will it be improved?
You can, when you save files now on iOS, you've had this ability for a little while now. But you now also have it on OS X. When you save files, you can apply tags to them, and you can now, you'll be able to search by those tags. So it's really useful if you decide all of a sudden that you're going to use it a lot. And doing that, you know, you can go in and you can tag files that you've written, you know, that all pull into a certain theme. So maybe you're working on a project and you aren't the terribly organized type to put everything in, you know, matching labeled folders and things like that. You can tag them as you're using them, And then when you go to search, you can just search by that tag, and everything that applies to that tag will come up.
Now, does that sound like something that would be useful to you?
It sounds like something that would be incredibly useful to me the very first day that I turned my computer on.
Right.
You know,
damage done. It's too late now.
Exactly.
Okay. You wanted to talk about Xbox One too.
Xbox One and the PlayStation 4. This was late last night for the PlayStation 4. Sony and Microsoft are both at the E3 Gaming Expo over on the West Coast right now, and they have both taken 2 hours out of their day yesterday to talk about the new game consoles that are both going to be coming out this holiday season, their pricing and their functionality. And of the two, Microsoft is going to have the Xbox One for $499 when it comes out in November, and Sony is going to have their console, the PlayStation 4, for $399. So, I mean, on price alone, you're definitely looking at, you know, Sony being priced way better than Microsoft here. But also, there's been a lot of controversy about how Microsoft is planning on handling used games for the Xbox One. And so that's gonna play really kind of heavily in Sony's favor this year, I think.
Because the point is that you can't use the used games.
Well, you just have to go through a lot of stuff.
Okay.
You know, like if you take a game over to a friend's house and you share it with a friend, if you're not logging in with your account on their Xbox, then that friend has to pay a fee in order to use the game. And if you go to sell it, then there's some extra steps you have to go through. Microsoft has put, you know, kind of a lot of stuff there, and it's probably going to upset a lot of people.
Okay. You know, I didn't ask you anything about the Apple's, you know, operating system changes. Is that going to cost the consumer anything?
They haven't made that clear, but I don't think so. You know, each one of these changes, especially for iOS 7, it should be a pretty minimal change. If they decide to charge for OS 10 Mavericks, it'll probably be something like $20.
Okay. All right. So.
And both of those things are coming out in the fall, so we're not going to have them for a little while.
Okay. All right. Gives us time to get used to it. Cope with the change. All right, Father's Day. I asked you to come up with some Father's Day ideas, and you did.
I did come up with some Father's Day ideas. I guess we'll go from low to high. I don't usually talk a whole lot about smartphone and tablet cases, but I found these guys called Tech 21, and they use an impact gel that they call D3O, or it's called D3O. They don't call it that, and it works very similarly to a non-Newtonian fluid, if you're familiar with that. And the idea is that it has the strip of this material on the inside of the case so that when you drop your phone and it's in this case, the case will absorb way more impact than, you know, a case that does not have this strip. You know, most of these cases for the tablets and for the smartphones, they're all, you know, usually under $30, and they're available for sale on Amazon and a bunch of other retail stores, but they're very, very cool cases.
All right. I have a case that's like really thick rubber, and if I drop my phone, which I have before, it bounces.
This will bounce as well, but these cases are not, they're not very bulky. They don't have a whole lot of extra material.
Okay.
Because they're able to line the inside of these cases with this D3O material instead of just adding a ton of extra rubber. So, I mean, you'll get a lot of the same effect. It's just a thinner case, which will feel better in your hand and in your pocket.
Yes. Okay, so that's the low tech and probably a little somewhat affordable gift.
Yeah, definitely a little in the way of the affordable and lower. We can talk mid-range.
Okay, mid-range.
I recently spent some time with a backpack called Tilt, T-Y-L-T. Is the name of the company, and their energy backpack is definitely for any kind of user. They took this backpack and they made it so that you could stuff it full of gadgets and be very, very organized about how you ran cables through the backpack. So maybe you're on a day trip or you're going to a theme park or something like that. The backpack has a battery built in that can charge smartphones and tablets and things like that. Is a very large battery and has a 10,000 milliamp hour battery, which on a single charge could charge an iPhone something like 12 times from dead.
Wow.
But you can charge multiple devices simultaneously from it, which is also kind of useful. So if you've got you know, a group of people that you're going to wear, or if you are like me and have too many things on a day trip, then you can fit everything in here. What I really liked about the tilt bag was just that the cables were incredibly organized. Everything was very well laid out, and the bag could fit just a ton of things. I was very, very happy with it.
Is it just for tech stuff, or could you put, it's just the only backpack you'll need?
It's definitely the only backpack I'm going to need anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy with it. They're $150. They're available for pre-order. Now, though, I think they're going to be on sale probably at the end of this month very, very early into next month. But the bags themselves are pretty inexpensive when you compare to other, you know, gadget-specific bags, and you can use it for anything.
You know, I haven't been to an amusement park in a long time. Have you?
I mean, I try to go at least once a year with the whole family, and then I usually will take my kids at least once or twice during the
right.
summer.
Yeah, you have kids. So, I mean, little kids. So do they have charging stations and stuff like that now at amusement parks?
I've seen a couple of them that do, like Disney will have a couple of charging stations, but usually it's kind of a standalone kiosk, and unless you're kind of hovering next to the kiosk, or
right.
you're, you know, brave or dumb enough to leave your phone somewhere, then, you know, it's not as big a deal. I definitely prefer this design, and, you know, there are a couple of different options. You can have the standalone back, the battery that you can just kind of plug into anything, but those, you know, you have to manage the cables yourself, and you have to worry about not losing the battery. And sometimes those batteries can get kind of hot, and all of those things are handled for you with the tilt backpack.
We have a question from the Peanut Gallery about your reference to non-Newtonian fluid, which I just pretend is like, what are you talking about? This goes back to the Tech 21 tablet smartphone cases.
Okay, so D3O is a material that is very flexible when you slowly go and move it and push it and meld it around, and it'll you know, form to pretty much whatever design you give it. But if it receives impact or is hit very hard or you know, is suddenly jolted, the material becomes very rigid and absorbs impact.
As opposed to every action has an equal reaction.
Exactly.
Newton. Hello.
I would highly advise you go to YouTube and just look up non-Newtonian fluid. There's hours of video that'll just leave you in a drooling, impressed state.
All I have to understand is, I get it. I completely get it now, and thank you very much for that. All right, so we just talked about the tilt backpack, and you also, we are really running out of time, but the Matthias laptop?
Yeah, the Matthias mechanical Bluetooth keyboard for Macs, and, you know, in theory, it'll work for anything else. Laptop keyboards, you know, if you're the kind of person who has a laptop setup where it's also plugged into a monitor or something like that, the keyboard can often be kind of far away. This is a Bluetooth mechanical keyboard that is separate from just about anything else and can be used, you know, in conjunction with really any kind of keyboard. They're $130. It's an incredibly comfortable mechanical keyboard if you're a fan of mechanical keyboards. Mm-hmm. And it actually has two USB ports on the side that'll work with the laptop as you plug it in.
All right. Well, if folks want to check it out, we'll post these on Facebook today if you weren't able to catch up with us. Check out non-Newtonian fluid in your spare time. Russell Holly, thanks a lot for joining us today as usual.
Thanks a lot.
It's Russell Holly. He's a tech blogger for geek.com. He joins us as every week on Tech Tuesday. Thanks for joining us yourself. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.